Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 282 of the Fun with Cars, Formula One, and Other Motorsports podcast, or episode 16 of 2021. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Robin, how are you?
I am doing well, considering. It is Wednesday afternoon, April 28th. And Chris and I are going to talk about the two opening rounds of IndyCar. Round one was at Barber Motorsports Park in Alabama, and round two was street course at St. Petersburg, Florida. And the reason why we are a couple days late and why I'm only doing so-so under the circumstances is very early Monday morning, my mother's mother, my grandmother, passed away. She did so in her own home in very peaceful circumstances, but she was a very important part of my life and a hugely important, for obvious reasons, important part of my mother's life. So we're definitely, as a family, we're having to grieve and console each other. So that was the cause for the delay, and for that I do apologize, but life happens, and this is a part of it.
Yeah, well, obviously, my condolences, Robin, to you and your family, and I'm sure the listeners will feel very much the same way. And we hope you guys are all coping with the situation.
Well, I sincerely appreciate that. And it is kind of ironic and understanding, I think, to many that doing things like putting together this podcast is a very important part of the healing process and keeping ourselves going in amongst personal tragedies and those types of things, you know, personal loss, those types of things. And I'm not even sure I said it yet, but we're getting back to the podcast. We're actually also going to have an interview with the team owner of Meyer-Shank Racing, Michael Shank. That's going to be coming later as well. So this is going to be a very IndyCar heavy podcast. And we will cover a touch of Formula One news, though, because there is some of that. But I apologize for jumping back and forth. But, you know, moving on from my grandmother's passing, who was just a wonderful, wonderful woman throughout, I'm going to honor her by keep doing this. And I'm sure that's what she would want. So with that, Chris, I know you caught at least some of these IndyCar races. I wondered if you wanted to talk about that, or if you wanted to start with the Formula One announcement of qualifying races.
Oh, let's talk IndyCar. There's a few Formula One things, but I think we should devote the majority of the pod to the two IndyCar races we've had. I think both were quite interesting in their own right and quite different finishing orders as well. So Alabama.
Absolutely.
Was a debut win for Mr. Palou, I think is how you say his name. That's what I'm going with. Palou. 24 from Spain. Debut last season. And he's a winner. And he did it very comfortably, I would suggest, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he would contend about the specific levels of comfort. He was he was getting some pressure from various people. But,
like Will Power.
Yeah,
but
exactly right.
He dealt with it.
He did so, and he did so admirably, obviously taking the win. It was a great opening race, and it saw a lot of action, and it was nice to see that IndyCar is showing its ability to bring diversity in the winner's circle and doing so right in the opening round with a non-established driver right at the off, I thought was telling for what we can expect for the rest of the season.
I mean, it was probably influenced by the rather large shunt on lap one caused by Joseph Newgarden, though. I wonder if the finishing order would have been slightly different had we had a few more finishes of lap one. But yeah, I mean, he certainly controlled the race and didn't flinch when, you know, the likes of Power and Dixon and Award were closing in on him in the final laps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree. Great to see another winner in IndyCar.
And there was, you know, it kind of goes back and forth because it was with one of the powerhouse teams. Palou is now a Ganassi driver alongside Scott Dixon and Jimmy Johnson. but he's, I believe, a sophomore driver.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, young, 24, and did a great job to establish his credibility with his new big team. Having to fend off those people, you're absolutely right that Joseph Newgarden, having that very uncommon mistake that he did, and, you know, spinning out on his own and in such a crowded part of the opening lap, such that many people found him sideways or backwards as they went over a blind crest and had nowhere to go, that certainly thinned out the field.
Yeah, it was an interesting one, that, wasn't it? He got, I can't remember which turn it was, but he got a little wide. But he had a, I think he came out of the corner, had a moment, I'll correct myself, he had a little bit moment, then went onto the grass, then lost it completely, spinning down sort of in the center of the track, collecting yes. cars every which way. but it was entirely his own mistake. I mean, it wasn't like he got touched or was trying to avoid someone else. He literally just lost it on his own. So obviously, you know, caught out maybe with tires that weren't fully up to temperature, or maybe a little bit optimistic on the throttle application. But yeah,
or a combination of those two,
right? And you know, from a man of his stature, it was quite a surprising mistake, and not a great start to his IndyCar challenge.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And another driver that made a mistake on his own, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. I do want to talk about this at length, but Jimmy Johnson, Jimmy Johnson, still getting his head around what it's like to drive an Indy car compared to a Cup car, and those just turning right is such a new phenomenon for him, and definitely getting the neck muscles built up on the other side of his head, and all that has to be done. So there's a lot of work to do. It clearly. Jimmy Johnson is on a steeper learning curve than the other rookies, even though he's also a 7-time NASCAR Cup champion. And the reason why I say that is all the other rookies have come up turning both right and left in their careers. And Jimmy Johnson's still getting his head around both directions. He's not an ambi-turner, as the great Zoolander once said.
Yeah, I mean, so my words suggesting that a former NASCAR great would take to IndyCar like a duck to water came back to haunt me when I saw his spin in Alabama. And, you know, he just got past, hadn't he? And he was, maybe he had a little bit of dirty air, but it just seemed like he got a little bit offline over a crest, and the car got away from him. And to compound his problem, he doesn't seem to be that familiar with how an IndyCar operates in terms of low speed maneuverability. He doesn't know how to get to reverse, which we discovered in St. Pete.
Yeah.
So I think he spent about four laps trying to engage reverse. So he really looks out of his depth. And I think if he was, you know, Jimmy Johnson, the rookie that no one had ever heard of, some would be questioning why he has that seat. So I'm wondering.
They'd want to know who his rich dad was.
Right. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, I never have.
Oh,
followed.
It's Jimmy Johnson of the Johnson & Johnson family. I see. That's it. That's who it is.
Or maybe they think there's a sub fortune in the family somewhere. But that's a different JJ, isn't it? But the thing is, I never, not being a big follower of NASCAR, did he, when they used to run road courses, was he successful? I mean, to your left
and
right. So he was able to put a Cup car through the road course tracks fairly competently. Did he win any races in the Cup car?
That I don't know by heart, but I know that he was plenty competitive on them. But, you know, this is a very different... You know, NASCAR Cup cars, I believe, are minimum weight is 3,400 pounds or 3,600 pounds. It's somewhere in there. And they generate downforce, certainly. And they're quite sophisticated. They're quite, I should say, more sophisticated than they appear when it comes to aerodynamics and downforce generation and things like that. But you're talking about, you know, 1,000 pounds of downforce versus 5,000 pounds of downforce in an Indy car. You know, mm-hmm. something in generic terms, we're talking about those kinds of ratios. And grip from the tires is probably an order of magnitude different as well. Maybe not as extreme, but the IndyCar is a much more capable machine in terms of taking a corner quickly. And
oh, absolutely.
And in that sense, it's just, it's very different in terms of its sensibilities and sensitiveness to throttle application, steering application, brake application, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you could just where he's losing it, you know, over humps, taking dips, just like when energy transfer is occurring, when weight transfer is occurring, the rear end gets light or what have you. That's what's throwing him off. It's just a completely different set of equations that he has to mentally make, and just all his constants are way, way off, to put it in engineering terms.
Yeah, I mean, they did do a reasonable amount of preseason testing, so I imagine he's had got, you know, a reasonable amount of mileage in the car. I guess the effects of having downforce and then being robbed of it, or having the influence of wind affecting the levels of downforce, may be something that he's quite unused to. But
that's a good point. That's a very good point.
I think in the first incident in Alabama, you could argue that the other car had an effect, but at St. Pete, he was running on his own. And
a couple of times. I mean, multiple times he was running on his own with his,
yeah,
yes.
But before he lost it, I mean, so he was running on his own without any cars around him. And he, I mean, the spin there was bizarre.
But honestly, my point, he had a couple of spins, one more damaging than the other, of course. But he was off course a couple of times at St. Pete, and it was all on his own. Yeah. And I mean, there was, if, to be blunt, there was evidence of this going into this, because he competed in the 24 Hours of Daytona and 12 Hours of Sebring in a DPI car, and there were issues there as well, certainly at the 12 Hours of Sebring, where he was making mistakes. You could argue that he was quite green at that point, but still, as you mentioned, he did do a lot of testing. There's going to be a level of patience that everyone has, and are the coffers empty yet? I'm not saying they are, no, but you know, he's two races in, and he's making a lot of mistakes, and I think people will start to need to see progress sooner rather than later.
Is he running this weekend in Texas or not? There's the doubleheader in Texas Saturday and Sunday. I can't remember. Is he sitting those out, and someone else is filling in the seat for these two races?
I think, well, that's the irony. Yeah, I believe he's only doing,
the road courses.
Yeah,
because you would have thought he might actually be more comfortable running on ovals, right? Even though obviously the cars, as you pointed out, are very different. You know, he's run obviously most of his career on ovals. So yeah, that's not going to help him, is it? Because you know, a couple of good results on an oval in an Indy car is going to build his confidence up, and then hopefully when he gets back to a road or street course, it might be, you know, might be a better level. But yeah, it's worrying signs. I mean, they do look like really bad rookie errors. They look like a guy who's got, you know, really still trying to get to grips with the car, and it's going to be way off the pace. And you'd have to expect that even with his reputation, and obviously, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of sponsors out there who love to be associated with him. But, you know, if this goes on all season, you wonder if that's going to put an end to it. I can't see this going on for very long at this level, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have we've had those conversations multiple times about, are really the 20 best drivers in the racing world in Formula One right now, when we see some performances that we see? Well, we have to a certain extent, you have to ask the same question of IndyCar drivers, at least regionally, at an absolute minimum. And yeah, Jimmy Johnson is not displaying that at this point. But, you know, again, his reputation does precede him, and that will give him the benefit of more patience from people. But thus far, both Alabama and St. Petersburg were not good examples of capable performance. But I'd like to move on to another rookie, one Romain. Now that he's in America, it's Grosjean.
Big John. Let's call him Big John, as Jenson Button likes to refer to him.
But yeah, Romain Grosjean, he's made his IndyCar debut as well. He is now two races deep, and he has finished both of those races and showing competency, which that seems like faint praise, but I don't mean it as a jab. I mean that he's showing that he has potential here.
Yeah, I mean, he finished 10th in Alabama, didn't he? And I mean, obviously that was helped probably a little bit by the four or five DNFs that were caused early on. But yeah, it certainly looks like he's taken to IndyCars a lot better than Jimmy Johnson has. There's no doubt about that. And I didn't see much footage of him during either race, honestly, because he wasn't at the thick end. But yeah, I mean, he seems to be a reasonably competent low key start, which is probably what you want to do, really. You just get your feet under the rug and get comfortable, and then see where you can go.
And he finished 13th at St. Petersburg, and you know, completed both races. You know, and
yeah, good mileage, you know,
again. Yeah, exactly. Not competing for a race win or podium, perhaps, but he's in the thick of it, and he's racing. And there were good battles he had in the mid pack, and you know, considering that it's a new discipline with new racetracks, it's I think a very commendable start. There's enough new for Romain Grosjean going on, and he's not with one of the big teams. He's not with Ganassi or Penske or even Andretti. So having that kind of start, I think, is absolutely fair. And I actually just remembered a point I wanted to make about the Joseph Newgarden spin. So we're going to go back a couple of steps. I apologize for this. But one thing I really wanted to point out that I think is a key benefit and a strength of IndyCar over Formula One, there were no discussions about track limits that cause Joseph Newgarden to get a penalty or something like that. Joseph Newgarden went off track, and the second he was off the track, he was on grass. And once he was on grass, that's what caused the spin. Now, you can make a safety argument if you want, but this is racing that I understand and I appreciate, which is there are no track limits other than the natural track limits that are so crystal clear and obvious that no one dares cross them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all like the old school F1 type track, like we saw in Imola, where if you go off track, you get punished for it. I don't think any real racing fan loves the car park sized runoffs that allow you to run wide back on the track without any penalty at all. I mean, no argument for me on that one.
Yeah, but even at Imola, there were a couple of corners where there was runoff and there was a track limit issue. And I think you apologize my poor memory on this, but there were people that had some track limit issues in practice and maybe even qualifying, where in the areas where there was runoff, they were getting, maybe it was during the race where folks were getting black and white flags and they had to back off.
No, you're right. I mean, we had Lando Norris lose his qualifying time because he ran, I think, 3 centimeters over the track limit.
And that's this old school track that you're talking about that has this issue. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I mean, not every track can be Monaco, can it? With walls around the entire perimeter of the circuit and you go and centimeter offline and you're going to, you know, break a suspension.
Yeah, you're going to be in the harbour.
I think there's a balance to be found. I mean, you could argue that were track limits really necessary at Imola versus, say, one of the more modern tracks like, Bahrain or Abu Dhabi. I think it's where you have, and even at Circuit of the Americas, I mean, I remember being shocked last year, the year before, when I watched the IndyCar race at COTA, and the guys were taking one turn completely off the track, and they were running.
I believe it was turn 19.
Yeah, and it was, so no track limits were being imposed, so therefore they were using the asphalt that was outside of the circuit limit to improve their lap time. I mean, so yeah, it swings and roundabouts, isn't it? I mean, I agree with you.
They were completely off the track just because there was so much runoff there to gain time on.
Yeah,
the first few times I saw it, it just looked goofy. But then once you were used to it, you're like, well, the racetrack is over here now, effectively, because this is the faster way around.
Yeah, I mean, I do favor tracks that punish mistakes and increase the stakes for drivers. I mean, we obviously want safe racing. We don't want injuries, deaths in race cars. That's very clear, but yeah, having tracks that that impose their own limits, I think, are certainly what I prefer. And, you know, you could see that even a strip of grass can cause lots of trouble. No argument for me. And, you know, the thing with the US is that although we're blessed with a lot of great racetracks in this country, a lot of them have been starved of, you know, significant investment to get them up to like an F1 track level requirements.
That's true.
And so they still have old school gravel traps and you know, safety measures that were maybe more in vogue 20 years ago, and they haven't all shifted to the massive runoff areas that they're all asphalted. So definitely probably a benefit to that. I mean, the downside is that we have to go to Miami for the second Grand Prix, and we're not going to, say, Mid-Ohio or Road America or Laguna Seca for a second F1 Grand Prix in the States. But
well, indeed, you mentioned the car park size runoff areas at modern F1 tracks, and indeed, we're going the wrong direction, where now they're just going to car parks full stop.
Exactly.
For racetracks.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I think it's a fair point. I think one thing that caught my eye, just looking at the overall results from Alabama, was obviously Andretti Autosport had a bad day, not Rossi finishing the highest Andretti driver in ninth, and Ganassi had a great day with three cars in the top eight and with two cars on the podium. So, you know, it looked very much like Penske and Ganassi were, you know, off on a flyer. But then we had St. Pete, which was quite a reversal.
That's right. You know, Colton Herta is with Andretti Autosport, and or tied to it at least. So tangentially with Andretti Autosport. He did a fantastic job. The 21-year-old won the race from pole and just put on masterclass performance. And some credit has to be given to him. In fact, Mario Andretti was talking about how Colton would make a mighty fine Formula One driver, basically.
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, he said that, within an hour of the race flag falling, didn't he? I think it was a bit of a knee-jerk comment. I mean, I've been looking at Colton's sort of history. He certainly was willing to take some risks early on, spending a couple of years over in the UK and Europe, but he doesn't have the sort of typical F1 type junior formula racing experience that you might expect. I mean, I'd love to see if Mario's serious about trying to get him as a reserve driver for an F1 team and getting it on some tests, and let's see if that's really, really true. I think, you know, the traditional, there haven't been too many Formula One drivers that have come through the IndyCar route of late, has there? I mean, there was a bit of a trend 20 years ago with your favorite driver, Jacques Villeneuve, managing to make it through IndyCar into F1, and then of course we had the likes of Montoya, and Bourdais was able to rebuild his F1 credibility and get a seat based off of his rampant success in IndyCar after four titles. But it's not proven to be the pathway that it once was, and I think the reason for that is we've had a number of drivers that have dominated in IndyCar gone to Formula One and done quite poorly. Yes. So I think you know, I agree with you. It was a wonderfully composed performance by Herta. He had Newgarden closing in, but seemed to have the race completely under control throughout. And I would suggest that if he can go on and start to dominate the season, then you know, Mario's words might have a bit more weight to them. But you know, you've got to be serious about finding a pathway into F1. He's not going to get, you know, a top line F1 seat off the back of winning a 2021 IndyCar title. There has to be more thought, more effort put behind it than that.
Absolutely. No, and to be fair, I think you're absolutely right that Mario made that comment right after the Grand Prix, and it was a bit of a stirring the pot, get attention kind of a comment anyway. But I think the truth in it is that Colton has been an IndyCar driver for couple years now. He's only now just 21, and he's still quite young, and I think that's the key. He's a proven race winner in IndyCar, still quite young, and that those two things combined, because clearly if you want, my true opinion is, you know, Joseph Newgarden, Alexander Rossi, guys like that are really truly IndyCar's best candidates for a Formula One seat of any kind. But would there be interest? We know matter-of-factly that Rossi has completely turned his head from Formula One. He was given Formula One He was given a Formula One offer. At least his name was circling around quite a bit. And as I understand it, he flatly turned it down. And this was after he had won the Indianapolis 500. So he's like, no, actually, I'm just fine here. And I would bet that that's the same with Colton. Colton has a very unique setup. He is racing with Andretti Autosport, which is one of the big teams. His dad, who is also a former IndyCar driver and IndyCar winner, is his race strategist and the one on the radio with him. Mm-hmm. That would not be the case in Formula One, certainly. And I think that Colton has a very, very sweet setup here and would have, I don't think he'd have interest in changing that. So it's a bit of just, it's an academic conversation as much as anything.
Well, but I think it's an exciting one. I mean, I think one thing that Formula One needs is a really good American driver who is in a reasonably competitive team.
And Jimmy Johnson might be available soon. Seven-time Cup champion.
But even in an uncompetitive team, I mean, I would be much more excited about seeing him in a Haas this season alongside Mick Schumacher than I am about Nikita Mazepin. I mean, there's nothing about Nikita that interests me, honestly, other than how short can his career be in Formula One so we can put someone else in.
Well, his nickname's pretty great. So.
So having someone like Colton Herta in there with a proper commitment, not a Michael Andretti style token effort, but you know, really go for it, proper testing plan, you know, put a couple of seasons in running F1 cars when they can, you know, through the rookie tests, getting a reserve driver role and properly doing it, I would absolutely be, you know, whether it's him or another US-based driver or another US driver would be awesome. But someone's got to put some real effort behind it. And I don't see that initiative. Haas clearly a struggling.
But again, I mean, look, Rossi definitely did that. And he got the break with, I believe it was Midland F1 at the time. Was it Midland or was it a different name by then?
Let's go with that. I can't refute that, so I'll go with Midland.
But Rossi, you know, he got 5 Grand Prix starts to his name, and he went through, he was in Europe, he went through that work, and I think he proved very capable in terms of talent. He out-qualified his teammate more occasions than he didn't. He had good race pace, and that didn't turn into anything. You're absolutely right about what you're saying, but I think there's also like a psychological barrier that it has to break as well with Europe accepting American drivers.
Well, I think the point is that it's not just going to be down to the driver, is it? It's going to have to be either a sponsor-led initiative, or it's going to have to be someone like a Roger Penske or a Michael Andretti himself, the Andretti organization, trying to pull some strings and finding a way to get him in there. So, you know, I could see a possibility of Andretti and maybe a wealthy sponsor coming in to trying to help Gene Haas out and install Colton or someone else in a car, whether it's, you know, for this season and next as a reserve driver, maybe looking for a race seat in 22 or something like that. I mean, that's what it needs. It needs an initiative. I mean, the US has so much resource and capability in motorsport. This appears to be a lack of interest in really trying to get a US driver in an F1 seat. That's sort of my take. You know, if the will was there, it would happen.
And the great irony is what do we now have? We have a US team principal in Zach Brown at McLaren. We have a US team owner and team in Gene Haas and Haas. And we have Formula One itself now being an American company. So, I mean, Formula
One... The stars
are
aligning, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's... The U.S. has always had a lot more connection to Formula One that's largely been under the radar for a long time, for decades. And now there's nothing under the radar about it. It's very heavily intertwined with the United States. I mean, gosh, the Netflix series and everything. But these are just the last bits of it that just aren't breaking through. So we'll see. So I'm riding my hopes on Jimmy Johnson. The IndyCar is just his final warm up till he till he gets the ride with Ferrari. That's my guess. A bottle of gin on that one. He'll be replacing Charles Leclerc before the end of 21. That's my bottle of gin bet.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to accept that. Do you think that Hertha
you don't
was...
want the free bottle of gin I'm offering you?
Oh, I'll always take a free bottle of gin, but I'm not taking any of your reverse psychology bets.
Well, another team and driver that had a very respectable start to his IndyCar season in 21 was Jack Harvey. He finished 11th in Alabama, not quite top 10, but respectable out of 24 cars, and a very strong top 5. He finished 4th in St. Petersburg, Florida. That's Jack Harvey, and he is the one full-time driver for Meyer-Shank Racing. And I spoke with Michael Shank leading up to the first Grand Prix in Alabama, so this interview is 10, 11 days old now, but he had a lot of really interesting things to say and gave us a great glimpse into his IndyCar season and IndyCar as a whole, and we touched on IMSA and some other things as well. So let's listen to this, Michael Shank. Michael Shank, you are the team owner of Meyer-Shank Racing.
Correct.
You and I last spoke January of 2020. At the time, you were running GT3 cars in IMSA at the 24 Hours of Daytona and a part-time IndyCar program.
Right.
Now you're running prototypes in IMSA and a full-time IndyCar program with two cars.
That's right.
It's been quite the year for you.
Yeah, I mean, we've been working on it pretty hard, and a lot of this has been planned or, you know, we've been trying to sell for a long time. We're a prototype team from 2004 to 2016 in IMSA. And we went off and Acura asked us to do the NSX project, which we did, and Penske ran the prototype program. And we wanted to be back in prototype, and Penske's contract was up, and we pitched for it, and, we were fortunate enough to get one of the cars. So it's exactly where we want to be for now and in the future. And we have a long-term contract with Honda and on the sports car side. And, we look forward to win a lot of races for them.
And if I have this correct, you are still running the GT3 cars as well, correct? So you have a prototype car, GT3 cars and the Indy cars.
No, we have no GT3 cars. We're only prototype.
You are now prototype exclusive.
Right.
Got it. And how has that transition been going to go from GT cars to prototypes and IndyCar?
Well, the IndyCar stuff we've been doing for 4 or 5 years. That stuff's just been getting stronger every year as we go.
And we're getting full time IndyCar.
It's we took some of the we had a 2-car NSX Acura team now we're just a 1-car prototype team. So we repurposed people in different areas, and the engineers from the GT program are now on the DPI program, and it's been and on top of that, we had a serious time crunch. So our last race of 2020 was in the middle of November. We got the cars at Sebring on Sunday after the last race, and we had to be in Daytona a week and a half later with the prototype car.
Wow.
So for the last 12 weeks, we have just been nonstop, and we've been behind a little bit, if the truth be told. And we've done okay in the first two races for sure, but we're getting caught up now and getting our legs underneath us, and it's getting stronger and stronger now. So
this was the 12 Hours of Sebring, the rescheduled 12 Hours of Sebring in November.
And right.
You went from that and then jumped into this whole new program.
Yeah, so that was mid-November, and we went and tested at Daytona December 3rd or 4th.
Wow.
And so we had to get the cars, get them to our shop, try to somehow rebuild them after Sebring, and then get our equipment and stuff ready to go. It was a lot. We were able to do it and got a lot done, and we're proud of it. But what I've found with our group is, we get in with a new project and it takes us a little bit just to get really comfortable. And then we typically have pretty damn good results. So,
hey, yeah, and you can't argue with that. So I want to
I would love to talk to you about IMSA a bit, but for this conversation, I'd like to focus on IndyCar. It's really exciting that you are now a two-car team. And are both cars running full-time?
No, just we're running Jack full-time, and then we're running Helio Castroneves for 6 races this year. And his first race is the Indy 500.
Got it. Okay. And that must be really exciting to have a veteran join your team like Helio Castroneves. But, you know, Jack Harvey is a veteran all on his own.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, Helio's won the thing 3 times, and the amount of experience he has is untouchable. I mean, it's just so good. And it really came to the front last week. We were there at the Indy Open Test, and Helio was very quick, very good in traffic, really pushed Jack, taught Jack some things. That's exactly what we had hoped when we hired on Helio. So, you know, we're real fortunate to be able to get him. We don't think he's done yet. I mean, obviously he's been around a long time, and we got questioned on that a little bit, but his demeanor and his work ethic and his fitness is second to none. So I look forward to seeing what he does this year. Of course, we're you know, our big thing is the Indy 500, as most people are in IndyCar. So we hope that that will help bring our whole thing up some. So
yeah, Castroneves' enthusiasm and energy levels are as high as ever as well. I spoke with him last August, and he's just as pumped up as he's ever been. And, you know, he told me once that he wants to keep racing until he's 50. And that means he's got quite a few years left. So I think that he's going to be, as long as you have a car for him, he's going to happily hop in it.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. Your body, because I'm that age now, you know, what you just described, and, you know, your body, you lose a little vision, you lose half a step in this period between 45 and 50 years old, I think. And we'll see how he reacts to it. Some people perform at the top and can keep going. So I have a feeling he's probably that kind of guy. And in the meantime, we, you know, our partners love him. They signed on to support because who he is and just how good he is with people and doing his sponsor stuff for us and relationships. And I mean, that's a huge part of this. Of course, we need a result ultimately, but he brings a lot more to the table. And that's, you know, and we love having him around. He's a great guy. And conversely, we've got Juan Pablo that drives for us on the sports car side, another slightly older guy that I love to death. I just think he's a rock star also. So I'm not afraid of age, especially with the greats. And those two are specifically. So.
You know, JPM probably has some of the best natural speed, you know, we've ever seen, right? So Jack Harvey, full-time in IndyCar, what has been the steepest learning curve getting a full season going for Jack?
Listen, you know, for both of us, you know, we've put, with Jack specifically, we've had a very purpose-built program. This is his 5th year doing something with us. You know, we did Indy in 17, we did 6 races in 18. We did 10 races in 19, and we did the whole schedule in 20. It's very purpose-built, okay?
Yeah.
And this is the year both of us, him and us as a team, have to get some results if we expect to go further forward. So we've done everything on the team side. We've done everything we can to make sure his equipment's at the top level with regard to money. Like, what more could we spend? We couldn't, you know? Mm-hmm. So we've given him everything we can, and we just need some luck. The team needs to perform and support them like I know we're capable of, and it starts tomorrow, and we'll see where it ends. There's no, you know, expectation wise, there's no reason we can't have 3 or 4 podiums or 5 podiums and at least maybe 1 win if things went our way, and that's what we expect. Let's see what happens.
You are not being bashful about results, and that's fantastic.
Well, I can't be. I mean, we built this program on a stair step, and now we're at the top of it.
Well, yeah, no, I totally understand where you're coming from. So you have, you know, the IMSA racing experience, and that's what your crew has been doing, you know, Indy as well. Do you feel inherently more comfortable on the road courses and street courses, or do you feel equally comfortable at the ovals, obviously including Indy?
Well, interesting enough with Jack last year, we, you know, that first race we came out of the pandemic, the COVID thing on June, we went to Texas and we were supposed to test there and we never did. So We showed up at Texas and Jack had never been there, and it was really tough on him and the team. By the time we got to the end of the race, we actually had the speed where we need to be. I knew we'd be good on road courses and street courses. We always have been reasonable speed. And as it turned out, you know, we had a lot of great qualifyings last year in the fast six, which we're really proud of. But what really surprised me is once we got past Texas and we went to the short ovals, we were quite competitive, actually, which was great. And then lastly on that, when we tested at Texas about a month ago, we left there third quick overall out of 19 cars. So yeah. We were pretty happy with that upgrade from last year. And it goes, you know, both of us, Jack and us as a team, you know, getting stronger. And that's how this deal is supposed to work. You know, we set expectations every year with based on what we have commitment wise, what can we financially do? And every year we've stepped it up. We've done exactly what we told the series, Jack, the media, what we would do over the last 3 years. And that's what we kind of intend to do. And now we're starting a second program at six races, just like we did with Jack. And, you know, we'll kind of see where it goes.
Oh, that's fantastic. So tomorrow is a road course, the Birmingham Motorsports Park. It's a lovely facility. And then you go to a street race in St. Petersburg, Florida. Do you feel confident that you'll be competitive at either or both of those places?
Yeah, I think we have a really good chance of being fast at all of it. I mean, this series, I just can't overemphasize how tough IndyCar racing is. And it, you know, if you watch Drive to Survive on Formula One, which is a great Netflix show about Formula One, and you look at how happy those folks are when they're eighth or ninth and they get points, it's just a different thing here in Indy. In IndyCar, all of the cars, given the right circuit, every one of them could win the race, all 24 of them, given the right strategies or the right thing go their way. And there's nothing you can do about it. And that's what I think make IndyCar so difficult. I heard a quote in Marshall Pruitt's story yesterday from Ron Hunter Race saying, IndyCar is a war right now. It's really difficult. And the reason is everybody is so close in speed. And it used to be you could say, okay, we know these three cars are going to be slow. We know we're not going to have to deal with them. That's just not the case anymore. And you have to consider everybody in the equation and focus on your own problem or on your own program. And I can't tell you how precise it has to be in order to score. And when I say score, I mean finish in the top three.
Gotcha.
Every little thing has to be perfect.
So you're looking at Ray Hall and Dale Coyne just as much as you would be looking at Andretti Autosport, Ganassi, and Penske, it sounds like.
Oh, well, yeah. The Ray Hall won this race last year, 2 years ago. Last time we were here, Ray Hall won the race. But the open test last week, you know, Graham was the fastest non-tow recorded time the whole day. And Sebastian Bourdais was right in the mix of it at Texas. He's with Foyt now, but I'm just saying that it doesn't – everybody is so close right now. You have to consider everybody all the time.
Absolutely, yeah. And you feel confident in Honda power this year? You feel like they're right there? Because there's been this interesting swing, and last year Honda definitely seemed to have the edge.
Honda had, you know, but, you know, Chevy had the edge a year before that, right? So Honda, I can tell you Honda have not sat on their advantage that they've gained. You know, they're making gains just like Chevrolet will do. Just reading a story from Chevrolet and Ilmor, you know, they didn't sit on their hands. They're going to have something for us. And the year before last, they were stronger than us. So it ebbs and flows. But you got to understand, these motors are so stressed. They have tweaked these motors so hard to get up to where they're at today. There's not a whole lot left. We go to a new engine formula in 23. So, but nonetheless, I think you're going to have 18 Hondas at Indy and probably 18, for sure 17 Chevys, probably 18 Chevys. We'll be at 36 cars, and it's probably going to be a dead heat. It's the team that worked on every little part of their car for quali that will qualify well there, which is important. So we qualified 20th and got up to 9th and finished 9th, which I'm proud of, but it's hard. It's hard to advance.
Very hard work. Yeah.
Harder to advance. Yeah. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's been frustrating that IndyCar hasn't been able to get a third engine supplier, but at the exact same time, just as you say, it's been fantastic to see the competition at every level, the engine competition, the team competition, the driver competition, the number of race winners IndyCar's been producing, the close racing. There's been so many strengths. So hopefully that you can just become more and more established in that building partnerships and staying in IndyCar gets easier, not harder.
Yeah, it really is. I think when you look at it, like, why don't we have a third partner? There's lots of answers to that question, a third engine partner in IndyCar. You know, in IMSA, we have, I think they have 15 OEMs racing in IMSA now. So what's the problem here?
Yeah, I think it's easier to count the engines that the teams that aren't the manufacturers.
Yeah, pretty much. Absolutely. But what I can tell you, if from an outside looking in, for a manufacturer to come in now, it's daunting because the other two have so much experience. But here's what I like best about IndyCar. Both the current manufacturers have said that to IndyCar, listen, we'll help. We will help get them part of the way there, right? Like, we want another. They really do. They don't want to be running 18 cars apiece at the Speedway. They really don't. I'm telling you. Okay. It'd be wonderful for another manufacturer to come in and solidify something here. But I think it's pretty daunting on the technical side. Not, trust me, they're all capable, but pretty expensive. We thought we were going to have Ferrari there for a while, and they've gone the sports car route, it seems. So, you know, I don't know. Let's just hope we can get it done. If anyone can do it, Roger can do it. And let's hope they can kind of work it out, you know?
Well, Michael Shank, your growth as a team owner has been nothing short of impressive. I've been attending the, except for this year's, I've been attending the last few 24 hours at Daytona. It's been really awesome to see how your team has progressed over the years and see you get more involved in IndyCar and things like that. So my next question for you is, are you going to get into Formula One, or are you going to be the one buying IMS from Penske in a few years?
That's hilariously not funny. I'm totally content in doing what we now do. Now, listen, it gets brought up a little bit because, you know, part owner of my team is Liberty Media, and they are very aggressive in buying things, including Formula One. You never know, I guess, where it goes in the future, but we're totally happy just trying to eventually get to two Indy cars at some point here full time. And I'm good in my world here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your world is very exciting to watch, and we'll certainly be cheering for you. I've always appreciated your approach to racing. Obviously, you came from being a driver yourself, and, you know, you've always been open and honest with media, and it's always appreciated. And so I want more team owners like you out there, and I want guys like you and you specifically to be successful. So
very nice of you. Yeah, thank you. Very nice of you. I appreciate that very much.
Well, hey, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Good luck at Birmingham. Good luck at St. Pete. Good luck this season. And we'll be excited to see how Jack Harvey does and how Elio Castroneves does as we get to Indy.
All right, bud. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Michael Shank. Appreciate
bye-bye.
It.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Yeah, so Harvey himself had a, you know, strong qualifying performance lining up in second place. And I think he should really have finished higher than fourth. They left him out on the reds way too long, didn't they? He had a couple of really, really tough laps at the end of that stint. And you know, once they got him off those tyres, his pace for the rest of the race was strong. I mean, he wasn't able to make any passes, but he didn't lose any more positions. And he himself said post-race that he was a little frustrated finishing lower than his starting position and was really hoping to get a podium. But, you know, you have to say it was a strong effort because the car and Harvey certainly looked competitive all weekend. And, you know, they were surrounded by Ganassi and Penske cars. So, you know, he finished comfortably ahead of Dixon and just behind Pagenaud. So, I mean, it was a good weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack had, you know, a so-so race in Alabama, but yeah, just as you said, very strong qualifying. And I think that speaks well to what his and indeed Michael Shank's goals are for the 2021 season, Michael fully expects, Mr. Shank, I should say, fully expects Jack Harvey to be a race winner if circumstances allow them to be this time around. So this is a team that, much like Dale Coyne was not that long ago, was a small underdog team, but is quickly building up. And, you know, Michael Shank now runs a DPI car in IMSA and a full-time Indy car for 21 with none other than Elio Castroneves joining for the Indianapolis 500 and then some races after that. So this is an operation that is quickly growing, gaining strength, and getting momentum. So it was a strong performance for Jack Harvey, but one that, as I think was pretty clear, Meyer Shank fully expected.
Yeah, I mean, on the evidence of St. Pete, at least, it looks like they've got a decent setup for street courses. So obviously the proof will be in consistency across the season and on the ovals and, you know, slightly stronger performance on the road courses. But yeah, great to record such a good result so early in the season. A couple of other standout performances for me were Sato and Power, who both made quite a lot of places on their lamentable grid positions. Power managed to get up to 8th and Sato was 6th. So the first of the Rahal cars. So it's good to see Takuma being feisty. He doesn't stop entertaining, does he? He's always been quite a feisty driver, and he hasn't lost it as he's maturing.
He's always fantastic to watch, absolutely. And Sato's in his mid-40s. So, yeah.
Great age to be.
Absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. And he's, you know, IndyCar is in a fascinating place because there are quite a few drivers that are nearing or cresting 40 years old. And they're proving that you can be, you know, you can have had, you've been able to legally buy a drink for several years and still be a quick racing driver, I think is the point. And, you know, Will Power, he's right around 40. He's obviously not slowing down. Scott Dixon, he's still quite competitive. There's quite a few on that list. I mean, Sebastian Bourdais now.
Yeah.
There's several on that list, and they're all mighty fast. I mean, Bourdais was another one who, you know, he wasn't really chasing victories here, but he was strong in a lot of places, and he's not at a big team, AJ Foyt. So
fifth in Alabama and 10th in St. Pete. Two good weekends, Bourdais, definitely.
So yeah, absolutely. But I think but we should say that IndyCar is racing yet again this weekend. It's going to be the first oval of the season, and that's going to be something that I will keep my eye on, but have not as strong of an interest as I did in these first two road courses. Critically, Formula One is also racing again this weekend. So we will, the next podcast will cover the Formula One results extensively. And I guess that's as good a time as any to jump into the Formula One news of at least 3 Grand Prix going to have qualifying races.
Yeah, it was unanimously agreed by all 10 teams. It's going to be introduced, as you said, this year at 3 Grand Prix. We don't know which Grand Prix they'll be, but the rumours are maybe Silverstone will be one, maybe Austria another. And the weekend format sounds really interesting. So we'll have a free practice one on Friday. Then we'll go into a qualifying session that we're used to seeing on a Saturday afternoon, that will set the grid for the sprint race that will be run on Saturday after free practice 2. So we'll still have 2 sessions on Friday, 2 sessions on Saturday, but we'll now have a meaningful session on Friday where the qualifying will set the order for the sprint race, which then subsequently sets the order for the full-blown normal Grand Prix on Sunday. So honestly, on paper, it sounds quite interesting.
What about points? What points are going to be rewarded, if any, for this qualifying race?
Top 3 will get, I think, 3, 2, 1. Obviously, first place, 3 points.
Interesting.
So, I mean, it's a little bit like the fastest lap point that was introduced, right? It hasn't really resulted in swinging of a championship. It's hard to see, you know, 3 points versus 25, this doing significant games with the destination of the championship,
but it
to the best driver
could potentially add up 3 points again and again and again.
Well, if you were running 22 races, I agree, but with only three this season.
Yeah, this season around. Yeah. I'm for in foresight thinking if this became a thing, right? Yeah. You know, you're absolutely right for this season.
But I was thinking about, so I'm old enough that when I started watching Formula One, they used to have 2 one-hour qualifying sessions, one on the Friday, one on the Saturday. And there were occasions where, the times from the Friday session would actually set the order for Sunday, or you might have some drivers improve their times and some not. And so the grid wasn't always set by the Saturday session. Sometimes it was set by a combination of the Friday and Saturday. And if there was rain, oftentimes it could be the Friday times that set the grid. So the point being is that Friday used to, in the history of the sport, used to be a meaningful day because the Friday times could establish the grid order. And we've lost that a little bit in recent times. And there was all this chat about eliminating Friday entirely. And what I like about this is it brings back more importance to the Friday running of a Grand Prix weekend. And it now, you know, if you have a bad qualifying on Friday, you're going to be low down the order in the sprint race. Yeah, okay, you might be able to recover some positions, but will you be able to get to your natural order for Sunday? I mean, there's going to be lots of interesting permutations on how this plays out. And of course, how much do you risk on a Saturday in a sprint race if you damage your car? Now you may hamper your efforts in the full Grand Prix. So it's going to be like a really tasty hors d'oeuvre, I think.
Yeah, no, I of all the different things they were talking about to, you know, quote unquote spice up the weekend, I am reluctantly willing to give this a try. I still feel it's a little bit much, but we'll see how the execution of this actually happens. And I certainly am willing to give this more of a chance than that knockout qualifying shenanigans they tried a couple years ago, which was just utterly silly. So we'll be interesting to see. This one, I think, is highly sensitive to execution. So we'll see how it's executed and then go from there. And perhaps what this was is the teams were taking this over something other than, 'cause if we don't do this, we're going to do something that's even sillier.
Well, I mean, for the sport and for Liberty Media, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of casual F1 fans that don't even pay attention to Fridays, right? I can't imagine the viewing figures for the Friday sessions are that high. You know, you have to get into the really hardcore
totally
fans.
Fair.
This elevates everything up by a day, right? So now people who used to tune into qualifying have more incentive to actually watch the Friday sessions. And those who just like watching the races now get to watch two over a course of a weekend rather than one. So I think, you know, from a exposure, from a global viewing perspective, this should be a positive step, I would think. And, you know, you never know with just a sprint format. I imagine there'll probably be no pit stops. You know,
I certainly hope not.
Yeah, short and sharp. I mean, it should be relatively entertaining, I would think. So yeah, I think that's positive. I guess other F1 news. One significant bit of news that came just today is that the Canadian Grand Prix for 2021 has been cancelled and has been replaced.
I did not know that.
Yeah, replaced by Turkey. So I think the current COVID lockdown initiatives and quarantining rules in Canada have meant that F1 can't visit this year, unfortunately. So we'll lose Canada for the second year running, which is a shame because I do love Montreal and the F1 race in Montreal. I've been there once. Such a great weekend. The whole city embraces the race.
Absolutely. More so than I've seen anywhere else.
Right. And the circuit, you know, leaves a little bit to be desired, but it's always produced some interesting races over the years and possibilities for overtaking. And
some of the best racing that has occurred in Montreal, despite you're absolutely right. The circuit on its own is not the most titillating, but the racing, again, I can't remember. I never remember if it's 2010 or 2012 where Jenson Button ended up in last place and finished, got past Vettel on the last lap. Just brilliant racing occurs there. And the race and the Wall of Champions, and there's a lot there.
Yeah,
but also, Turkey is a great track
stuff
on its own. I certainly don't mean to diminish Turkey.
No, Turkey's a good circuit, and it was a shame we lost that, actually, because it was one of the better Hermann Tilke tracks. But yeah, I mean, I certainly hope this isn't a permanent demise for the Canadian Grand Prix. Hopefully it'll be back in 22. But that's some big news, especially seeing as you were advocating for driving to or flying to Canada versus Austin in our last podcast. The other bit of news was Callum Ilott, who was second in the GP2 championship last year, who didn't make it into Formula One, unlike the likes, Mick Schumacher
reserve
and
driver.
Company. Yeah, got the reserve driver at Alfa Romeo, and that sort of got me thinking that maybe that's bad news for either Kimi or Giovinazzi, that maybe their contracts for next season could be come under pressure if it impresses in testing.
Well, Kimi's far too young to think it be thinking about that, Chris. So it's Giovinazzi that we
Fangio's
have to pay
record.
Close attention to.
Is he going to try and beat Fangio's record for the oldest F1 driver ever?
There's two things about Kimi Raikkonen to point out. He does not care. He just wants to keep racing. Hugely respect that. He named his son Robin. Come on. He's the best. That makes him the best driver. Period. There's no equivocation there. He stands alone as the best.
Okay, well, I don't have much to argue against either of those points. I do wonder,
because they're irrefutable. That's why.
I do see a longevity issue with that lineup, though, of him and Giovinazzi. So it doesn't surprise me, because with the current reserve driver, who is still a reserve driver, is Robert Kubica. But I can't see him ever getting a Grand Prix start again. Bless you. And so I think Callum's put himself probably with some Ferrari assistance into maybe pole position to get a seat once it becomes vacant at Alfa Romeo or Sauber, whichever you prefer.
Well, we should pay close attention to see if there's FP1 stints for him that pop up sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, of course, the rookies that have come in have covered themselves in so much glory so far. Who wouldn't want someone else from the school of GP2 in 2020?
Oh, jeez. Oh, man, I think that's a lovely, lovely point to end. So I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcast. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. And please go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/RobinWarner. My most recent review was of a Honda Ridgeline. It is a great review. I highly recommend it. Completely unbiased opinion of my own personal review. Chris, I want to thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye, and thinking of you, Grandma.